Hello and welcome back to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast, everybody. I'm Dane Cash, and we have a traveling Cosmo Catalano, bike racing analyst extraordinaire. He is traveling from a bike race. He was actually at a bike race in person. Cosmo Catalano, when is the last time you were at a, you know, UCI level tier event?
Probably Tour of Colorado back in 2014. I think 2014 Pro Challenge or whatever it was used to be called.
Yeah. Welcome back to the covering of the bicycle races world.
Nice. Yeah, it was good. I had real creds this time. The ones you have to pay money for. So that was kind of cool.
As in video creds.
Yeah. Well, yes. I spent a lot of time just trying to stay off camera, and I still got caught once or twice on the camera. I was very upset.
So
look like
but I would like to point out, so the event that you are at, I noticed, I mean, I didn't watch too much of it, but I did notice that the cyclists at this event, they were riding on these bikes with wide tires and flat.
Yes, it was a mountain bike race. I believe if you wanted to, you could ride on a drop bar bike with narrow tires, but you would not be very successful.
You could do the cross country events maybe. Probably the downhill events might be a challenge, right?
Yes, downhill events would not work well. The short track, I still don't think you could be competitive on a cyclocross bike, but you could have a cross race there with cross bike rules and make everyone ride cross bikes, and it'd be okay. So,
yeah. All right, so we're talking about Mont Saint-Anne in Quebec in Canada, which hosted the final round of the UCI Mountain Bike World Cup. We'll talk a little bit about that later, but first. Well, let's get through the intros. Okay, we're done. Because it's just Cosmo and me this week, which, you know, due to a confluence of circumstances, the other various people who often join us couldn't make it this week. And so you, dear listeners, I believe for the first time in the history of Pretty Serious Bike Racing, are going to have to just content yourselves with the two of us hosting the show.
Right, but the old heads who remember Recon
yes,
Ride.
Yes, fortunately, yeah. Anybody who's been around long enough will know that Cosmo and I used to do this. We would talk to each other, and people did listen. People found it interesting enough that we did it for several years. So the hope here is that, you know, you'll find it interesting.
This is basically like, you know, Jodeci fans buying the Casey and JoJo album.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a deep cut reference. I mean, is there that much overlap between like late 90s, early 2000s R&B?
I mean, you got it immediately.
I did. I have taste. I know what good music is. So, yes. Anyway, actually, who's Casey? Who's JoJo? Anyway, before we get into any mountain bikes, before we get into Paris-Tour or gravel, and even before we get into the final monument of the season, just really quickly, let me just tell you that if you haven't headed over to escapecollective.com/join yet, if that's not something that you've done yet in your life, and you're listening to this podcast, I feel like you should go do that. You should head on over to escapecollective.com/join, sign up, become a supporter of everything that we're doing here, support Wheel Talk and placeholders and Geek Warning, even Geek Warning. Ronan McLaughlin's got a great new podcast, and all of those things are made possible by people like you, our listeners. So we hope you'll head on over.
I did listen to Geek Warning on the drive back today.
Wow. They'll be so happy.
They didn't even make fun of us. I was a little disappointed.
It does seem a little bit one-sided. I mean, Ronan messaged me a few weeks back about like asking about this. Like, what's the beef? And I said, there's no beef. We just say on the podcast that, yeah, so we invented it.
I believe that when Escape first launched, Kaylee was talking about the most popular podcasts, and he said it was between us and Geek Warning, and that we were yes. slightly ahead. And I think you said, take that, geeks.
This did happen. I did say, yes. The problem, though, is that I now know, months after that Geek Warning is ahead of us. And so I try to keep a low profile, you know, because this is a situation which, if this were a sporting event, they would say, scoreboard. You know,
you can't just sweep that under the rug, though. We clearly need to up our game.
We do. One of the things that we could do is just do a you and me podcast. Let's just have a conversation, just Cosmo and Dane.
We should
talk. Oh, hey, that's what we're doing. Right. Let's talk about Lombardia, because it's the final monument of the season. I love this race. It's a race that ends up every year entertaining us. And this year, when I wrote the preview, you know, I thought I was being smart. I thought I was, after having done a lot of consideration, you know, I thought, I think Primož Roglič is in great form. And I know Tadej Pogačar is Tadej Pogačar, but I think this is going to be Primož Roglič. That was me when I was writing the preview. I was wrong. Can you give us a 15-second rundown of why I was wrong, as in what happened in this race?
Well, I got to start it with Ben Healy going from 80K out, because I said that that wasn't that good an idea. And Abby Mickey herself responded to me on Twitter and said,
wow,
how dare you? Because that's a long way, he got caught around 37 kilometers to go.
Abby so you were Yates right was, in the
end. I was, well, I mean, it's me, right?
Right, of course.
Yes. So Adam Yates had been setting pace at the front of the group and reduced it to a pretty small number of people. And then Jayco, Simon Yates' team, took over a few K, and Roglič and Pogačar just kind of didn't go with them. They kind of hung back in the group and sort of looked at each other. Eventually, Pogačar went across. Vlasov went with him and was like, whoa, what's going on here? Vlasov is up in his game because, you know, Roglič is going to be on his team. Roglič eventually woke up and brought the back group back up to them, and then just kind of fell asleep as Pogačar rode clear right over the top and onto the descent and got 37 seconds by the bottom of the descent. And then it looked like Pogačar was cramping, and then maybe Remco in a second chase group brake checked Mark Hirschi. But in the end, nobody caught Pogačar. He won his third consecutive Lombardia in pretty impressive fashion, especially kind of fighting through a cramp up those last hills.
Yeah, there was a very brief moment where it seemed like
oh no,
what's happening? But he ended up being fine. You know, he got a little food from the team car and
salt tab.
Yeah, so watching the race, you know, in person, I have to say, it's like example number 27 of how I think I'm conditioned. I think my brain says, you know, okay, the gap is X. That means the rider does or doesn't have a chance of winning. And I think I need to recalibrate the math. And I know this already. I've thought this thought so many times in the last 2 or 3 years. But I didn't think Pogačar was going to make it when he had the gap that he had coming off the bottom of that climb. I figured, oh, well, there's several riders behind him. Enough riders to catch
him. He still had Adam Yates in the group. And Yates, in his post-race interview, was like, yeah, I was flicking the group, as usual. It was very much you know what's fun about being Pogačar's teammate is that you get to mess with everyone else in the break once he's, or everyone else in your group once he's up the road.
Yeah, fair enough.
So,
still, it wasn't really even close in the end.
No, not at all. It was not there was nail-biting, what was it? 10K, 12K, whenever Pogačar was punching his leg.
Yeah, that brief bit. Yeah.
And I mean, he was coated in salt. Like his shorts were rimmed. It was like a, you know, bowling alley tortilla chip. Just pick it up and the salt trumbles back down into the bowl.
The analogy that you're making is gross, but also I want one.
Now. Yeah. I mean, sodium, you can't say sodium without yum, right?
So that's wow. I never thought of that.
you haven't been, what is it, hyponatremic enough?
I guess not. By the way, that's something that's in the past. It's been a thing for him. We've seen at the Tour de France, we've seen him covered in salt.
It was a major, major reveal.
So in the end, it wasn't close. My question for you, I have my own answer, but my question for you is, could anyone else have done anything? Or was there no chance ever? Was Pogačar always going to win?
1,000% someone could have gone with him when he went away. There's an overhead shot of him. They just handed him a gap. Roglič just doesn't come through. And I think it's Vlasov who's up there too. And he's thinking Roglič is going to come through. And then there's three bike lengths. And then there's enough separation that the group is well, you know, I don't really want to chase. And then it's a pretty twisty descent. So it's really hard to kind of leverage numbers. And it's just by the bottom. Then he had a big gap. And who wants to try and close that? Plus Yates is there. But no, it seemed a little sleepwalky from Roglič. Because earlier, he kind of, it took him a few moments to decide he wanted to respond to Pogačar. It was very strange.
I do wonder, I mean, in that descent specifically, like, even if somebody had gone with him over the top, and there was a moment where the gap was nil. I mean, like, it really could have closed it with not that much effort.
Okay, I don't want to say I could have closed it.
I think you could have. I think that is an accurate statement.
And I'm not already on the limit, and I haven't ridden 200 and whatever kilometers, and you said close that gap to Pogacar, I could probably do it.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably accurate. And yet, my question, though, is, you know, even if there, if somebody had been on his wheel, would that have really mattered? I mean, he descended quite speedily.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It wasn't quite terrifying. It wasn't like a, you know, vintage Salvadelli or Nibali performance. It was competent. I think he's had some issues there in the past, and I know we all think Pogacar is a natural talent who never has to try hard at anything, but he may have actually practiced some of the corners because he was getting space on the moto when he got moving, but it wasn't like kind of otherworldly, like he's out of frame and the motorcycle has to go 120k on a straightaway to catch back up. So I think it, you know, if in theory, right, his tires and your tires are going to be about the same. You just got to do what he does, commit, and believe that everything will work out. So I think someone could have gone with him. I don't know if the whole group could have, because it's really tough when you get the kind of slinky, when everybody has to break for the corner, the last guy in the line has to break the most and then has to work the hardest to get back up. But I think at least one other rider could have gone with him without too much trouble.
All right, so my thought, the other thought, I agree completely. The other option, I think, yes, they could have closed him down earlier. I do wonder if Jumbo kind of wasted too much earlier in the race. You would wonder, if there had been a teammate in that group to just all-out pull for Roglic, he might have still been beaten by Andrea Bagioli in the end, but they also might have caught Pogacar and given Roglic a chance to go clear on that climb like he likes to do with a very late attack. Instead, Jumbo didn't, like, they didn't have numbers in the end, which is not very Jumbo-like.
Well, except in the long races, like we talked about last week, where they're just, they have, I think this may be a case of, like, and they, I think the GCN commentators talked about this too, how, like, 200-kilometer bike race, a lot of guys can perform really well there. 240-kilometer bike race with, you know, what, 15, 20,000 feet of climbing. Sorry for mixing my M&Ms and my Skittles there in terms of units. But what I'm saying is, like, a really long bike race, there are a very small handful of people who can bring it hard at the end. And the idea that you would be able to have three or four domestiques there to deliver that performance, I think maybe Jumbo needs to kind of rethink its strategy for some of these races. And like you said, do less work early. I think Tilla Valter, I think he could do really well if he didn't do so much work setting things up in situations like this.
Yeah, I mean, he was the one rider even close to in that lead group in the end. And he wasn't that close, but other than Roglic, he was the only one really who you could see maybe if he did a little bit, if he'd worked a little bit differently, maybe he's in that group.
But then again, who knows? If Jumbo doesn't control the race, maybe some situation happens. Jayco had two riders there.
That's true.
And UAE. That's definitely true. Was always, you know, if the Remco group comes back, like Hershey's there too, so it's always speculative. But I think this is another data point in our Jumbo does not do well at long length time, whatever, like longer events, monuments, basically.
Yeah, and also, I mean, another data point for something that we've already seen this year is that Adam Yates is a good bike racer, and that is helpful to Tadej Pogacar. He was like peppering the other riders with an attack on the final big climb right before Pogacar went, and that helped set up Pogacar. And I think that's a place that 1-2 punch for that team has proven this year to be. I mean, yes, they didn't win the Tour de France, but they did finish second and third, win some stages. I mean, like they had a heck of a tour with that 1-2 punch. And I have to say, I wasn't expecting Yates to be as good as he has been this year. He did win a world tour one day not very long ago in Canada. And yeah, and he was, I think, pretty pivotal to Pogacar's success at this race. And just, yeah, yet another data point of Jumbo coming in with a team that, you know, I think you look at this team and you think, oh, that's a really good team. And in the end, they don't deliver. And UAE, yet again, delivers for what is Pogacar's second monument of the year and, you know, nth win of the year. Yeah, he's pretty good.
It's really cool to see Adam Yates kind of thrive in this, maybe I'll try to win the race role. Like, someone else is more likely to win the race. I could still win the race, but I'm also primarily going to help them. I remember him being a very strong rider who would always not quite get it done as sole captain. And he just seems, this year especially, just thriving in that role. So
I think it's a good, you know, another good example of why riders go to teams that already have leaders for the same thing that they do, because you can still get your wins. I mean, you can still win. In his case, he won Romandie this year. He won a stage of the Tour de France. He won GP Montreal. Like, he won plenty of races this year, even though you would think Tadej Pogacar is the guy who's going to scoop up all the wins. And he sure scooped up a bunch of wins, but there was still plenty left for Adam Yates.
Yeah. Giovanni Lombardi apparently used to call them his pet wins, because, you know, 90% of the time he was leading out Cipollini. And so when he got a chance to be in the break and win a stage, it was his pet. His
little, I love
pet
that. Win. Yeah. All right, I want to give a little bit of a shout out to the guy who finished second in this race.
Because yes.
I got to say, I wasn't expecting this from Andrea.
No one was expecting it.
He did finish quite well at Gran Piemonte, in that he won the race, and he was on the podium at the Coppa Bernocchi, but neither of those is Lombardia. Gran Piemonte is, like, not, it's almost 100 kilometers shorter than a Lombardia. So just because you did well in that race doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to think you're going to do much at Lombardia. But there he was. He stuck with a group that included Roglic, Vlasov, the Yates bros, and the guy that finished fifth at the Tour de France, Carlos Rodriguez. So obviously Andrea Bagioli can climb much better than I was giving him credit for. He's the real deal. I think he's shown this sort of like Italian semi-classics classic season that Quickstep did a nice job kind of developing him into a talented young up and coming one day racer, and Lidl Trek's gonna love having him on the team next year. So you kind of feel bad for Quickstep losing him, and you know,
maybe, I don't feel that bad for Quickstep.
Well, okay, maybe not. And of course, he signed the Trek deal, and like it's after that that he's doing a lot of these really impressive things. So Trek's got to be happy. I mean, they already liked him enough to sign him.
Yeah, but Trek is going to be kind of a crowded house next year. That Lidl sponsorship really gave them a lot of resources to try and figure out new ways to bring people on and race. And, you know, there's going to be competition for leadership roles there. And also, maybe it was just kind of who was it who posted his ride from Vegas for Quickstep or something?
Malraux Schmid.
There was some side drama. Ugh. It just doesn't seem like a very fun place. Yeah, I mean, Quickstep does not seem like a fun place to be riding bikes right now. Even Remco seemed a little bit salty. He had an early crash, which is, you know, bound to put anybody in a bad mood. But it just, they've gone from Wolfpack, like, kind of seeming like a bunch of guys who really liked racing bikes together, to being like, I don't know, am I trying to make, who was the crazy Raiders guy who just, like, let the team do whatever?
Al Davis,
thank you. It was, yeah, except without the success, and yeah, late Al Davis Raiders.
Yeah. The later Al Davis, that's the thing. It's the later years. Yeah, it doesn't, I guess it doesn't really surprise me then that they'd be that there would be a bit of a bad vibe at that team right now, considering a bunch of those riders and soigneurs are all wondering, like, what's the deal with our jobs? You know, that's been their lives for the past 2 months. So that's,
yeah,
not much of a surprise. But Andrea Bagioli was a surprise. He has a heck of a sprint on him. The fact that he was able to stick with this very talented lead group of, you know, Grand Tour type riders all the way to the end of this race to finish second was really, really nice. And Roglic did still finish third. I do think, I think Roglic was maybe like a tick off of the best. And I think that made a big difference in the chase. He didn't do enough chasing. He didn't do much chasing. I assume he felt like, I'm not good enough to really lead the chase and then beat everybody, which I think probably would have been true. And without him to marshal them, the rest of the riders said, yeah, nah, nobody really worked together. And so I don't know that there's that much that Roglic could have done by himself. I have a hard time faulting anybody for the way this race turned out, except for, you know, right at the top of that, going over that climb, maybe you try to stick with Pogacar. I mean, easier said than done. But let's close it out with just a reflection real quick on Tadej Pogacar's season. You've been watching the sport for a long time, Cosmo.
Mm.
Can you remember a time, you know, when a rider was able to win Flanders, Amstel, Flèche, and Lombardia? I mean, maybe not even just those for specific races, but a rider of that sort of caliber, because even Valverde wasn't winning Flanders.
Nope. I think if Valverde had not been kind of enmeshed in Spanish cycling the way that Pinot has been enmeshed in French cycling, if he got on a truly international squad, I think he might have found a taste for Flanders. But no, you're completely correct. I can't, you know, Valverde is the only close comparison, and he didn't have the same success. It's pretty wild to see. And it's, as much as I would want the first 2 weeks of the Tour de France that we had this year to be the entire Tour de France, it's also cool to see Pogacar crack sometimes. Like, when he got those cramps, we're like, this is not entirely out of character. Like, this is a guy who gets a little too into it sometimes, forgets to feed, has vulnerabilities, while still being absolutely world-beating, you know, 99 days out of 100.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that in a way, it's also, I'm reminded of Vanderpool a little bit, where he's imperious when he wins, and even more so for Vanderpool, he does sometimes have bad days or just like, I don't want to be mean, but like he does dumb stuff sometimes, you know, and like really that makes stuff. It more enjoyable.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, it was way cooler that he crashed in Worlds and got on the bike and still won. Like that was.
Yes.
Because like.
It made it all the more entertaining.
I don't know what everyone else was thinking, but I was like, you know, people are like, race is over. I'm like, guys, it's Vanderpool.
Right. Yeah.
Anything could happen.
And it did. He still won. Yeah. Pogacar is the same. It was like when he started cramping up, it certainly seemed for a moment, it was like, oh no, what's going to end? But yeah, he still won. In terms of winning the specific races that he's won, like Gilbert is the only real comparison in recent years. But the funny thing is, or the interesting thing is with Gilbert is like, he kind of like changed his entire focus as a rider to go from being the guy who could win the Ardennes type races to being a guy who could win Flanders. And Pogacar just did it in the same year, which is nice.
And Gilbert also had a really strong team with a lot of weapons. And I'm not saying that Pogacar doesn't. We just talked about Adam Yates. But it was much more of a... He was not... Gilbert, when he won, I think, Roubaix, he was not the favorite to win that race.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He got out and he was like, well, this is Quickstep's guy up the road for them, and they'll use him later. And it was like, psych.
I think,
yeah, that's an advantage that Pogacar has not really been able to leverage. He's always been the dude, right?
Right.
Everybody is looking at him all the time.
Yeah.
So to come in with that target. It helps, but everybody has teammates, right?
I'm thinking it continues to get better, I guess what I'm saying. Maybe we haven't even seen, like there's a chance that I don't think we're going to see Pogacar ever racing under the radar the way that Gilbert did. Maybe in like 30 years.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's got these teammates this year who I think we're finally seeing a UAE team that is pretty darn good around him. So maybe we will see more of that in the future. Maybe never. We're never really going to see Pogacar attack from 100K out and people ignore him. That doesn't mean they're going to be able to catch him, but nobody's going to ignore him.
And I mean, Gilbert was never racing to win the Tour de France.
It's true. Yeah.
He'd
never won it twice already. Yeah, there's Lombardia for you. Tadej Pogacar wins the final monument of the season. That's two on the year for him. Mathieu van der Poel took two, and Remco Evenepoel.
I'm so stoked for Roubaix next year. He's doing Roubaix. It's happening. I know it.
I'll be entertained for sure. We didn't say much about Remco, but I guess we should mention poor Remco crashed early in the race. This is not a race that treats him nicely. Because, of course, he crashed over a bridge and horribly injured himself a few years back.
Yep.
So Remco Evenepoel has a complicated relationship with Lombardia, but at least his team did manage to finish second in the race, which, in the end, is probably kind of what most people thought might happen anyway. Just not with Andrea Bajuli. All right, that's Lombardia. Let's talk a little bit about a world championship event that happened over the weekend. We got to watch one of them.
We didn't get to
watch the other one.
That was a very strange decision.
It was extremely strange. And if you want more on that, Abby Mickey wrote a great piece over at escapecollective.com, which, yeah, I mean, there's no good excuse. There's no reason to not televise the women's race. There was no information, essentially, until the very end when we were told, oh, hey, Kashi Nuidoa wins.
Yeah, there were some, yeah, even the Twitter updates were right, bad.
Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. So that, I think, is one of the main stories of the whole weekend. That said, it shouldn't take away from Kashi Nuidoa taking the win. I mean, that congrats to Nuidoa, who is a rider who, on this podcast many times before, when we break down races, we say something along the lines of, and then Kashi Nuidoa attacked, and it was cool, but it didn't work. And that, like, I feel like that's like every week we talk about that.
A little bit. Sometimes her attacks are cooler than others. I wish I could have seen to really know what happened. I was looking at the results for another race we're going to talk about this week, and it was one of them said a reduced group sprint. One of them said an escape. It was very confusing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's always good to watch because people have different opinions about what is what. And on that note, I am still of the opinion that gravel racing may not be sufficiently serious for this podcast.
I agree that in general it's not, which is why we didn't do a whole Unbound episode. That said, Kashi Nuidoa happens to be a talented road racer. The same could be said for the guy that won the men's race. So Matej Mohorič won the men's race. He soloed to victory. The main reason I wanted to mention this is because I wanted to at least give a shout out to a handful of the kind of gravel focused riders. I have to say, I don't think I said this on a podcast anywhere, but I certainly, you know, said it to some people, you know, at Escape when we were talking about covering the events and just the week ahead. I kind of expected Keegan Swenson to. I hope he doesn't listen to this pod because I don't want him to think that I was underestimating him, but I was. I mean, I really was. I did not think he was going to be able to be up there. You know, guys who are racing the Lifetime Grand Prix circuit versus Milan-San Remo / you know, Liège winners, Alejandro Valverde at this race. But he did. He was up there. Yeah, he obviously didn't win, but congrats to Keegan Swenson. All right, Sunday, Paris-Tours. We saw, again, something that surprised me from an American.
Everyone was surprised. I mean, I don't even really know that you can correctly say that he attacked, that Riley Sheehan attacked, as so much as he got away in a section of the race where things were kind of up in the air. No one was really looking for a big attack, and he got a couple of guys with him who were all pretty committed, and the group was not, you know, it wasn't the last 3K. No one was like, oh, crap, we got to catch this, and yeah, it turned out they had a pretty good mix in the group. For some reason, FDJ sent Olivier Legac across when they already had Louis Askey there. And Legac attacked and didn't get away. And yeah, Askey was real tired because he'd been in an earlier breakaway. They tried to sprint for him. And Sheehan, you know, pulled it out at the end. It was close. It looked like he had gone just a split, like 20 meters too early, but held him off. And yeah, it was cool. I don't think anybody expected it. Love to watch it, though.
Rider who was racing for the Denver Disruptors most of the year. He's a stagiaire with Israel Premier Tech at this race. He won Paris-Tours as a stagiaire, which is kind of nutty. I mean, yes, it's not a World Tour race, so there are I think the caliber of riders at Paris-Tours is maybe slightly less than it would be if it were a World Tour race, and you know that's a whole other conversation. But
well,
still,
you know. I would counter that by saying that the Saint-Michel Mavic team is super extra motivated to get
That's
a good
true.
Result here, and they did get a pretty good result.
Yeah, they got fourth.
They got fourth, and they got like a buttload of camera time, and the guy, you know, rode his legs off. I don't know. I think of all the dot pros, this might be the most prestigious.
I agree with that. It is the number one non-World Tour race. Yeah. Well, anyway. Riley Sheehan, congrats.
Yeah.
Winning a big race when you're a stagiaire, 23 years old, lives and trains here in Boulder. So let's talk about NCL. I think that's a whole podcast.
It's a multi-part investigative series. Well, not investigative, but
should be.
Long-form narrative.
There we go.
There could be investigative aspects.
All right, in any case, congrats, Riley Sheehan, and looking forward to seeing what you do next. Still so young. I mean, Louis Askey still had a great day for Groupama. Also very young, 22-year-old Brit. And then Tobias Holland Johannessen has had a really nice year as well. Was very active at the Tour de France, 24 years old. So, nice showcase of the young riders at Paris Tour. Cosmo, what were you doing this weekend? Tell us all about it. I don't know, what were the interesting takeaways from this whole riding around on flat bar bikes thing?
Yeah, it was really fun. It's a lot. It was long days. I guess I made them longer than they needed to be. But yeah, I was up at the World Cup at Mont Saint Anne, the last one of the season, mostly because I had bought a bunch of video rights to make videos because I could get in touch with a human and talk about that, which has not always been the case. Part of that was that I could get accreditation, and so I got accreditation and went and filmed some parts of the race that I knew, based on the camera setup, weren't going to make the broadcast coverage, or at least the angle I wanted wasn't going to make the broadcast coverage, and tried to film from there. And that was much easier to do in the short track event, which was a super fast short loop, than it was in the XCO, which was just brutal. It actually looked really fun to ride, hard, but fun to ride in the dry, in the wet that they had the race in. It was borderline unrideable. I'm amazed that the Tom Pidcock and Matthias Flückiger were able to ride as much as they could ride. And I mean, there were, you know, grizzled French Canadians like trying to dig rideable dirt out from under the mud, like every time there was a gap in riders, and sometimes when there wasn't a gap in riders. There was a guy with a leaf blower trying to dry off the rocks so that people could reasonably expect to have traction. It was the most brutal imaginable conditions on a brutal course. A lot of suffering. And I mean, the start list was huge because there are two World Cup stops in North America. So everybody who could was out there. Saw a lot of people running. And, you know, knowing that these people would smash me in any competitive bike racing event really kind of drives home how hard this course is and how high the level is. And you see it, you know, Sam Gaze, Tom Pidcock, like mountain biking and road biking are both like the level in both is really high right now.
Pidcock took his first win in the rainbows.
Yeah. And he was excited about it. It was kind of his goal.
Wasn't it kind of like puncture city there towards
the
end?
Well, yeah, Matthias Flückiger, there were definitely, if you rode this course as hard as you possibly could on tires right, that were going to get you traction going up the hill, you were going to flat on the way down. Like, you really had to be focused and dial it back. And Flückiger was very willing to take risks. I think because even after the race, Pidcock said he wanted to descend behind Matthias because he was taking, it was just easier for Pidcock. He didn't have to think that hard about the lines. I think very much in terms of technology, we should be roughly equivalent. If your bike can do it, my bike can do it too. I think he just rolled the dice too many times and flatted, and he recovered from one flat really well, but you can't, even with the fast changes he was getting, you can't, against Pidcock on a course that brutal, like, you can't have that many things go wrong.
I guess unless you're Loana LeCompte, right? Because like, she had a crash and some mechanical stuff too, right?
It's true. That's a good point. She had some time though, right?
Yeah, she won. She won by 15 seconds, but she spent a while dealing with stuff, various things, crash, mechanical, whatever, you know, that. Yeah.
Yep. I mean, I was to say, honestly, the course side viewing is, and I mentioned, like, this is also with the stuff I said about filming where the cameras aren't, like, it's also really hard to kind of know what's going on in the XCO race watching in the woods, right? Because you see, it was after, you know, two laps, it was three riders. You know, maybe Landon Neff was going to get back into it. And you know, they'd go by in a certain order with a certain time gap between them, and then that'd be all you really knew. I suppose. I could have gotten on a walkie-talkie or figured it out, maybe streamed it to my phone, but the phone is also my camera, I didn't want to do too much at once on that tiny little screen in the rain. But it's very, like, that was kind of the hardest part, was like, I'd do this really long day, be out in the course running around in the mud, trying to get shots, trying not to have riders crash into me or crash because of me. And then I'd go back to the media room, try to download the race, and then go watch the race that I had just recorded. And so, yeah, it's cool because I think there's a lot of stuff you don't get from watching that you get at the venue. Like, there's you watch the broadcast and you're like, okay, they went up a hill and then they had a really scary downhill. It's like, no, they went up a hill for like 15 minutes. There was a very early kind of technical hurdle, not literally, but like a technical feature that you could probably clean if you went super duper hard. But then there was an unrelenting climb, and they did get pictures of this like kind of switchback climb. It really doesn't do justice to how steep it is. Then they went up through kind of another, there's a little flat portion where maybe you could recover, and then they went basically straight up like a blue ski run, and that sort of sloped to the left across peanut butter mud. Like it really drives home like how, like the Pidcock and Flukiger did not start slowly. They started in a way that was sustainable to be at the front of the race by the end of the race. You cannot go too hard too early on that course or kind of your day is over. And poor Christopher Blevins, I think, got pretty excited early in the early section of that race and suffered his way through to the end, well down from where he started.
Yeah. All right, lastly, let's talk about what's coming up, because there is still World Tour racing on the calendar.
It's a long season.
And believe it or not, Escape Collective has a reporter.
Woo!
At the Tour of Guangxi coming up this week. Johnny Who's Long there? Is going to be
nice
covering the tour. He'll be in China. We might try to get some audio from him. Tell us what's all about over there. So the men this week have the Tour of Guangxi, which is a stage race for the men. On the women's side, you have the Tour of Chongming Island, which is a stage race in Chongming. And then their Guangxi Tour is just a one-day event. So they have a women's Guangxi event, but it is a one-day race. So the women are mostly, they're going to spend most of the week racing in Chongming. By the way, yes, Chongming is in China. Not close to Guangxi. If you don't know your Chinese geography, you might assume, oh, great, they get to go to China and they squeeze in two World Tour Women's races, you know, in a short span of time, which is true. But these two places, Chongming and Guangxi, are about as far apart as Barcelona and Budapest, which is not close. So it's a long journey if you're trying to do both. But yeah, so on both the men's and the women's side, there's still some World Tour racing to look forward to. Escape has Johnny over at Tour of Guangxi. Hopefully we'll get to see some interesting action. The start lists are, well, it's a World Tour race, so.
I kind of wish more countries or regions that were not historically associated with cycling would do the Quebec thing. I think that's a really
yes
good and sustainable and like not pain in the butt model. One day races in the city, everybody can see it. It's easy to get from race A to race B.
Absolutely, yeah, agree. The fact, I mean, in Quebec and Montreal, both those races, you can see them go by at least a dozen times. So it's good bang for your buck. I mean, it's free, but it's good in terms of time. You go stand by the race and you get to watch them go by a bunch. And they're right in town, big population centers. So yeah, completely agree. Anyway, Tour Guangxi coming up. That's the last World Tour race. And we'll talk about it because we are pretty serious about bike racing. That's what they say.
Serious.
And that's it for us. Hope you enjoyed. We'll see you when we see you. And in the meantime, you'll be able to listen to Wheel Talk and Placeholders and Geek Warning. Go check out Ronan's new podcast, The Performance Process. Cosmo, great talking to you. Thanks for stopping in the middle of your journey back from Canada to make this happen.
This is a pretty spot to stop. I should probably come up here more often, but
yeah, where are you right now?
I am in Franconia Notch, Flume Gorge. I think is the name of this particular, it's the big rest stop info area. It's just a really pretty time to be up here. I actually like it a little bit later. I like it when the leaves are gone and up on the top, tippy top of the mountains, the alpine zone, it's winter and there's some wind packed snow. And down here, it's still kind of, you know, 45, 50 late fall, but I like it here too, you know, pretty much any time of year. So yeah. I realize I'm looking around as I say this and speaking away from the mic, so I apologize for any fading.
You're adding color to the story, so that's important. All right. I hope you enjoyed. We'll see you when we see you. Bye.